And talk about a man whose work perhaps isn't as widely known in the general public as it should be. He was described as the world's greatest talker, the century's most inspired reader, one of the finest minds of our time. I dug out an obituary in The Independent last night on Isaiah Berlin. It described him, I mean, the superlatives flow off the page here, and describes him as the century's most inspired reader, one of the finest minds of our time, and that he showed in more than one direction the unexpectedly large possibilities open to us at the top end of the range of human potential. He was an extraordinary intellect and someone we should probably try and understand a little bit better. With me this morning is Dr. Henry Hardy, a man who's dedicated his own career to ensuring that the work of Isaiah Berlin continues to be known about. And he's giving a talk on the 28th of May at Wolfson College, and he's on the line now. Good morning to you, Doctor. Nice to talk to you. Thank you for coming on this morning.
Not at all.
Extraordinary career Isaiah Berlin had, and you did know him, didn't you, for a while?
Yes, I knew him for 25 years. I was very lucky to.
When did you first meet him?
I met him in 1972 when I went to Wolfson College for an interview for a graduate scholarship.
And what was your impression on that first meeting?
I was immediately aware that he was an extraordinary man, unlike anybody I'd ever met. He was terrifically engaged and lively, and his intelligence sort of leapt out at you. And he asked unusual questions. He wasn't a conventional interviewer in any way. So, for example, when I said what I was proposing to do for my graduate work, he said, "Oh, are people still interested in that?"
And what was it? What was it that you were proposing to do?
I was going to do philosophy of mind. I was interested in the question of how we can empathize with other people, how we know whether they're feeling the same as what we are feeling. Is one of the hard chestnuts of philosophy.
There's so much we could talk about. I mean, the list of his achievements. He received the Jerusalem Prize, President of the British Academy, CBE, the Order of Merit, founder of Wolfson College, President of the Aristotelian Society, and it goes on and on and on. It began for him in the early part of the 20th century. He was born in the Latvian capital, Riga, wasn't he, in 1909. What do we know about his early life?
Yes, he was the son, the only child of a timber merchant, a man who owned forests in the heart of Russia and who had the timber sent down the river to the port in Riga, from where it was sent all over the world. But it also supplied the Russian railways with the sleepers that they used. So his father was quite well off, but of course he was a Jew, and that created a problem for the family. And eventually they emigrated to England, like so many Jews.
He came here when he was quite young. He was 10 years old, wasn't he?
11 when he arrived, yes.
Yeah. And was his father able to get work here? What was their life like?
Yes, his father had, with great foresight, deposited quite a tidy sum in an English bank, so that when he decided he needed to emigrate to England, he had the financial wherewithal to do so, and he set up a trading company, Timber and Bristles, in London. And that's where he stayed for the rest of his career.
And what do we know about Isaiah Berlin's early education then, in his early teens? What was it that took him from that young 10-year-old who arrived here as an immigrant to where he ultimately ended up?
Well, in Riga and subsequently in Petersburg, or Petrograd, as it was then called in Russia, he had governesses and tutors rather than conventional schooling. But as soon as he came to England, they settled in Surbiton, a wonderfully suburban place to go, and he immediately went to a primary school there. And then after that, he went to St. Paul's School in London, and then to Oxford. So from the time he arrived in England, he had a conventional middle-class British education.
What has been your lifelong fascination with him, to spend such a big chunk of your career, almost all of your career, studying one man? Is it that it is never-ending, that there is so much work to understand? Or is it just this pleasure in trying to understand what drives such a huge intellect?
I think, yes, his own personality, his amazing personality, unlike anybody I've ever met, is one of the main things. But it was allied, happily for me as an editor, to a great reluctance to publish. He would tend to give lectures or talks and then just stick them away in a drawer and not do anything about them. And he hated going into the final version of printing something. So he really needed what I could call an intellectual midwife to bring him to the public.
So you were like an agent in many ways.
Sort of, yes. Yes, I mean, a mixture of an agent, an impresario, and an editor. So, yes. He'd published terrifically little by the time I first met him. He wrote a book on Karl Marx in 1939, a biography, an intellectual biography, which is still in print and is still thought to be one of the best books on Marx. And then he'd published one book of essays called Four Essays on Liberty, which is he thought was his most important book and has been very influential. But apart from that, very little. And I discovered that he had written literally hundreds of things which were just sitting in drawers. So I started to bring them together and turn them into books.
What a treasure trove. As he wasn't a Marxist, was he? My understanding was that he was opposed to absolutism of any kind, really.
Absolutely so, yes. He said he was a visceral anti-Marxist, anti-communist from the very beginning. In fact, it all started when he was out walking with his governess in Petersburg in 1917 and he saw a mob dragging a policeman off to what was certainly going to be an execution, and that left him with a loathing of physical violence, of political violence in particular, which lasted for the rest of his life.
His wartime, I mean, so much we could spend 20 minutes talking about what he did during World War II in itself. He served in the British Embassy in Washington, didn't he, providing Churchill with summaries of American opinion.
That's right. He worked for the British Information Services, as they were called, and subsequently for the Foreign Office. And he used to survey the press output in America and also talk to various pressure groups and interest groups and report on American opinion to the British government. This was all part of trying to bring America into the war, which, of course, happened at Pearl Harbor.
And it seemed that many world leaders were interested in his views. He had quite a lot to say, didn't he, on the as a Jewish immigrant in Britain, on the foundation of what became the State of Israel.
Yes, he was a lifelong Zionist, and he became terrific friends with Chaim Weizmann, who was the first president of Israel. He met him in America, and he was very much a kind of, in private, an advisor to Weizmann and helped with the Zionist project all through, and remained a supporter of Israel for the rest of his life, although he didn't like many of the things which happened in Israel, like so many of us.
Was that why he refused to shake hands? There was an incident, wasn't there, in a lift in the King David Hotel. He refused to shake hands with Menachem Begin for some reason.
That's perfectly correct, yes. Well, Begin was, for him, a terrorist, and he didn't think that terrorism was justified in any circumstances, and so he refused to acknowledge him.
If we were writing the Dummies Guide, which is where we started earlier this morning, when we were talking about another subject entirely different, we were talking about particle physics earlier this morning, but if you were to write a Dummies Guide or a Fool's Guide to Understanding Isaiah Berlin's philosophies, is it possible to filter this stuff down, this massive amount of work, into bite-sized ideas?
In one way it isn't, because he gloried in particular things, and everything is what it is and not another thing was one of his favourite sayings.
Yes.
That comes from Bishop Butler. But underlying it, there are two main themes. One is what's called liberalism, or belief in the freedom of the individual as against totalitarian, authoritarian, fascist, communist, whatever you like, ways of suppressing the freedom of the individual. And the other element has an equally dull name. It's called pluralism, which you might say is the view that difference is terribly important and that we shouldn't homogenize things. We should recognize difference and celebrate it wherever it occurs.
My guest is Dr. Henry Hardy of Wolfson College. We're talking about the work of the genius Isaiah Berlin, and I don't use that word lightly. The talk that Dr. Hardy's giving is called The Genius and the Pedant at Wolfson College on the 28th of May, and we'll have more in just a moment on BBC Radio Oxford. My guest for these last few minutes is Dr. Henry Hardy of Wolfson College, is giving a lecture, The Genius and the Pedant, working with Isaiah Berlin at Wolfson College on the 28th of May. Dr. Hardy, we could describe you, I suppose, as a disciple, but my understanding is that he didn't like the idea of having followed, despite his fame, he really didn't like the idea of having followers or fans at all.
No, he didn't like the idea that people would subject themselves to the authority of another person just because they were the authority. He thought everybody should think for themselves and come to their own views. And he didn't want to have the responsibility of somebody citing him as their authority on all things intellectual. And I agree with that.
And yet, when you everything you read about him, every critic or anybody who heard him speak, they were in awe of his intellect. I mean, reading quotes last night of people who used to go and watch him, watch his lecture, queue around the block for his lectures, wherever they might be, at Harvard or Oxford or elsewhere. He had no appreciation of how popular he was at all.
No, he didn't. It was extraordinary. There were examples right through his life where he was astonished that something he did or said got publicity in the newspapers or on the radio or something.
Was that because he had low self-esteem or what? What was that about?
Yes, sort of, yes. He always said he was systematically overestimated. He always said that he thought he was a fraud and would be found out one day. He always said that anything he wrote seemed to him to be phony. He said it was like printing your own money. Because you'd made it, it couldn't be genuine. And that was, in a way, one of the attractive things about him. I mean, he had absolutely no trace of self-importance. I think, of course, that he greatly underestimated his own worth, but that's a much more attractive quality than to overestimate it, surely.
I found a quote from Christopher Hitchin last night, a great long essay, where he said, I propose that Berlin was somewhat haunted all of his life by the need to please and conciliate others. He said, a need in which some people is based, but which also happened to engage his most attractive talents, which plays into what you're saying there about that lack of self-esteem.
Yes, he saw that as a Jewish trait in him, and he didn't particularly like it. I mean, when he was once asked to fill in a famous questionnaire for a German newspaper called the Marcel Proust questionnaire, one of the questions is, what is your worst fault? And he said, anxiety to please. So he saw it as a fault, but it was certainly there. I mean, he was very anxious to be in with everybody, if you like, and he didn't like to be on the losing side.
Was he a happy man? What do we know of his personal life?
Absolutely, yes, he was. He always said he had a terrifically happy life and that he was astonished to have a happy life, because he described the 20th century as one of the most horrible centuries that ever been in terms of human suffering. But he happened to have, by a whole series of fortunate accidents, steered a happy course through all these tragedies. And in particular, he was happy in his marriage. He married in 1956 a woman called Aline Halban, and they were wonderfully happy for the rest of their lives.
And did they have children?
They didn't have children of their own, but she had three children by two previous husbands, all of whom are still alive, and he became part of their family very much.
And we're jumping around here. There's so much to talk about. We could do hours on this. You've dedicated your entire life to it. But the period when he was seconded to the embassy in Moscow, that was after the war, was it?
Yes, that's right.
And he met the novelist Boris Pasternak and others. He had some interesting times there, didn't he? My goodness.
He certainly did. The most striking encounter that he had over there was with a poet who is perhaps, again, as you were saying about Berlin at the beginning, not as well known among the general public as perhaps she ought to be, called Anna Akhmatova. She was a very noble, queenly, dignified figure who stood up against the Soviet regime in a way that deeply impressed him. And he went to see her when he was on a visit to Leningrad, as it was then called, and stayed all night. Until 11 o'clock the next morning, when he returned to his hotel, threw himself on his bed and declared, I'm in love, I'm in love. But he wrote an essay about his conversations, his all-night conversations with her, which is in one of the books that I edited, and it's one of his best essays. And if anybody's wondering, well, what to start with if they don't know his work, I would very much recommend this essay. It's called Meetings with Russian Writers in 1945 and 1956.
And there's the reaction of an academic and a brilliant man like this after falling in love or a night of lust or whatever it might have been, to go away and write an essay.
Yes. No, they didn't even touch one another.
It's
commonly supposed that they must have had an affair, but they absolutely didn't. It wasn't that kind of relationship. It was extremely intense and romantic, and she turned him into a sort of mythological figure in her poetry. In fact, he occurs in several poems, and she calls him the guest from the future, which is a rather mysterious phrase. But you're right, he was a very he was an intellectual, there's no getting away from it. He was very cerebral, and he was slightly awkward, could be physically, but that didn't matter. He was brilliant at being the kind of thing he was.
And they say he spoke incredibly fast, is that right?
Yes. there's a myth about that, which is put about by various people, including Alistair Cook, who did a piece on him when he died in his letter from America, and he said that he spoke at 400 words a minute.
That's fast.
But I think I was, as you see from the title of my lecture, I'm a pedant, and I was pedantic enough to actually time him, and it's nearer 160. But there's a nice story about the Oxford Conservative Member of Parliament, Monty Woodhouse, who said that Berlin was the only man who could pronounce the word epistemological as one syllable. That captures it in a way, because he did swallow his syllables, and sometimes he's a little bit difficult to follow.
Are there any recordings of his speeches anywhere at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things I've charged myself with as part of my work is to collect all the recordings of him. And there are a number of recorded programs on the radio, and also a number of filmed interviews. So there's quite a rich archive of recorded material, about 100 and something recordings.
Fascinating talking to you, and the talk is called The Genius and the Pedant. I know we've only scratched the surface, but thank you for the taster. It's the 28th of May, is that right?
That's correct. 28th of May, 6 o'clock, Wolfson College.
Thank you very much. Good luck with your work, sir. Nice to talk to you this morning. Thank you for your time.
And you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Henry Hardy on Isaiah Berlin. If that hasn't tempted you to find out more, then I haven't done my job very well this morning. It's